content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from Carl and Pat Kappen. We wish to thank them for their support. And a current timely topic, how D.C.'s newly unveiled World War I memorial commemorates the global conflict. The central figure, a 60-foot-long wall of remembrance, remains unfinished. By Livia Gershon. More than a century after World War I drew to a close, a long-awaited memorial commemorating the global conflict has opened to the public in the nation's capital. As Lolita C. Baldur reports for the Associated Press, the Great Wall is the last of the United States' four major 20th century wars to receive a memorial in Washington, D.C. The National World War I Memorial is a depiction of what happened 100 years ago when soldiers boarded ships bound for France, determined to bring a close to what they thought would be a war to end all wars, said Daniel Dayton, executive director of the World War I Centennial Commission, during a virtual ceremony held last Friday, per Michelle Stoddard of ABC News. By themselves, they, of course, couldn't end all war, but their courage and sacrifice did indeed bring a decisive end to a conflict that had killed millions. Through the official opening ceremony and raising of the first flag at the site took place on Friday, Stars and Stripes, Carlos Bongiorni points out that the central element of the memorial remains unfinished, a roughly 60-foot wall, 12 feet tall, bas-relief sculpture titled A Soldier's Journey. The Wall of Remembrance is scheduled to be installed in 2024. For now, a canvas featuring sketches showing the future sculpture stands in its place. The wall is the work of sculptor Sabin Howard, per Jennifer Steinauer of the New York Times. Its 38 figures tell the story of a reluctant soldier who returns home a hero, a tableau that reflects the nation's turn from isolationism to a position of global leadership. Starting from the left, the soldier takes leave from his wife and daughter, charges into combat, sees men around him killed, wounded, and gassed, and recovers from the shock to come home to his family, notes the National Park Service on its website. The monument is located in an area previously known as Pershing Park, now designated as a national memorial. The space incorporates an existing statue of General John J. Pershing, who commanded the American Expeditionary Forces sent to fight on Europe's Western Front. In addition to the design and construction of the memorial elements, the $42 million project included the reconstruction of the park, which had fallen into disrepair. The park is also a recreational facility used by tourists and local residents. Our objective was to build a memorial that would stand shoulder to shoulder with other monuments and elevate World War I in the American consciousness at the same time, recognizing that, unlike those memorials, this has to be a memorial and an urban park, Edward L. Fountain, vice chairman of the Centennial Commission, tells The Times. The memorial feature a peace fountain and panels engraved with information about the U.S.'s role in the war. ABC News says visitors can learn more about the history that the physical monuments commemorate via an augmented reality app or by scanning information poppies outfitted with QR codes, the red poppies that grew over Europe's battlefields became a symbol of remembrance for those who died in the war. WDVM's Anthony Ding reports that the Centennial Commission, established by the Obama administration through an act of Congress, launched a competition centered on the park's redesign in 2015. Of more than 350 entries, the commission chose the concept submitted by Howard and architect Joseph Weischer. Construction began in December 2019. Howard tells the Times that his mission was to make a sculpture that was both engaging and educational. He explains, "My client said you have to make something that dramatizes World War I in a way in which visitors will want to go home and learn more about it." Still, the artwork has faced criticism for depicting black soldiers fighting alongside white ones. In reality, most black soldiers who served during World War I were limited to labor battalions. Combat units were also segregated. Many black veterans returned home only to face bigotry and prejudice, as Joe Williams writes for Smithsonian Magazine's May issue. Howard says he changed the helmets of the black troops in response to the criticism, but did not otherwise alter their depiction because they needed to be treated as equal stature. According to the U.S. Department of Defense, more than 2 million U.S. troops served overseas during the war. Almost 117,000 were killed. The National World War I Museum and Memorial, an independent cultural institution in Kansas City, Missouri, commemorates the conflict as the country's official museum dedicated to World War I. "The Great War touched almost every American family at the time," said President Joe Biden in a recorded presentation screened before the raising of the flag. "For too long, that nationwide service has not been fully commemorated here in the nation's capital." Biden added, "This memorial finally will offer a chance for people to visit and reflect and to remember. More than 100 years have passed since World War I ended, but the legacy and courage of those doughboys sailing off to war and the values they fought to defend still live in our nation today." And that's by Leva Gorshon, a freelance journalist based in New Hampshire. She has written for The Daily Beast, The Boston Globe, Huffington Post, among others. And now we're going to jump to World War II. This article, "The World War II bomber that took more enemy fire than most others and always came home." Known for its memorable April 17, 1945 mission, the B-26 bomber, Flakbait, undergoes preservation at the National Air and Space Museum. And there's a picture of it. It looks like it's been sanded and is in the process of being restored. This is by David Kindy. "At a Ford airfield in La Coulette, Belgium, ground crews worked feverishly to ready the 449th Bombardment Squadron for another mission. It was April 17, 1945, and World War II in Europe was nearing an end, though the killing was far from over. As teams of men lifted heavy bombs into the weapons bay and started rotating the large propellers on the B-26 Marauders in preparation for takeoff, air crews went through checklists and studied maps in advance for their next target. Magdeburg, Germany." Sorry, I had to stumble over that word a little. "One flight crew examined their two-engine medium bomber with particular interest. The airmen must have wondered how this plane, marked with serial number 41-31773, but better known by the nickname Flakbait, was even able to fly. Across its fuselage was a quilt work of more than 1,000 patches covering holes, some as large as 16 inches, caused by shrapnel from exploding anti-aircraft shells on previous combat missions. This would be a historic flight for the aptly named Flakbait, and not just because it was leading the attack that day. Colonel John S. Samuel, commanding officer of the 332nd Bombardment Group in the 9th Air Force, had selected this aircraft as his flagship for the assault against Nazi targets in Magdeburg. The pilot that day was Captain William G. Fort. While Colonel Samuel served as co-pilot, they successfully led a strike against the German defensive positions and returned safely to the airfield in Belgium. But what made this day special for Flakbait was the number of missions. This was the 200th for the B-26-25MA, manufactured by Martin in 1943. For 2 years, the aircraft took everything the Germans could throw at her, including shrapnel from flak and machine gun bullets and enemy fighters, and became the American bomber to survive the most missions of World War II. 200 missions are a lot for any ship, but Flakbait carried her age well, Colonel Samuel would say later. All told, Flakbait flew 200 combat missions plus 6 decoy operations for a grand total of 206 flights. The only bomber to fly more missions was an RAF Mosquito known as F for Freddy, which made 213 times over enemy territory. Unfortunately, the de Havilland B Mark 9 bomber crashed during a war bond tour in Canada on May 9, 1945, 2 days after VE Day. Today, Flakbait is undergoing preservation in the Mary Baker Engine Restoration Hangar at the National Air and Space Museum's Udvar Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. And I'd just like to add, personally, I've been to the Udvar Hazy Center, and it's like another Smithsonian institution for airplanes. The one downtown is the main one, and then this one is out by Dulles Airport. Chantilly, Virginia, actually. Much like on that historic day 75 years ago, crews are once again working to prepare the plane for another mission, this time as a testament to the aircraft that helped win a war and the brave men who flew it. Dedicated experts are painstakingly conserving the aircraft so that future generations will have an opportunity to understand the sacrifices made by a generation of people during World War II. We are preserving, not restoring, this great plane, said Jeremy Kinney, curator of Aeronautics Department at the museum. We're cleaning and stopping any corrosion. Much of the aircraft had been kept in crates since the end of World War II, so there's a lot of work to do. The job is expected to be completed by 2025. The preservation of Flakbait ensures that future generations of museum visitors will be able to see the beat-up old bomber that Americans used to help save the world in the 1940s, says Kinney. But he adds they'll also be able to see its battle-damaged patches, its chipped and splotchy paint, and all the exhaust and mud stains that it wore during the days of battle. On the underbelly of the aircraft are the faded remnants of the invasion stripes painted on nearly all Allied aircraft just prior to D-Day on June 6, 1944. The markings were added to prevent ground forces from accidentally shooting down their own planes during the Normandy landings. Flakbait is the only American aircraft that flew D-Day missions to still have its invasion stripes. The U.S. Air Force, which wanted to preserve the Air Force because of its history, donated it to the Smithsonian in 1960. The forward section of the fuselage was displayed with the World War II Aviation Exhibition at the museum in 1976. Flakbait's story begins in 1943 when it was assembled at a Martin factory in Baltimore, Maryland. It was christened by its first pilot, Lieutenant James J. Farrell, who adapted the name of his family's dog, Fleabait, for the plane. The aircraft flew her first bombing mission later that year, on August 16, against a German fighter base in France. True to her name, Flakbait returned home from nearly every mission with holes punctured in its metal skin from anti-aircraft fire, or flak. The exploding shrapnel ripped through the aircraft, sometimes causing serious damage and wounding the crew. But Flakbait always made it back to base safely. Twice the plane returned on only one engine, and other times had her hydraulic shot out, with damage done to the stabilizer and other key systems. It was hit plenty of times, hit all the time, Farrell recalled in a 1978 interview. I guess it was hit more than any other plane in the group. The B-26 Marauder took her last flight on March 18, 1946, when she was piloted to an air depot in Bavaria for disassembly and shipment back to the United States. All told, Flakbait dropped more than 375,000 pounds of bombs, consumed approximately 160,000 gallons of fuel, flew 178,000 miles, and logged 725 hours of combat time, a remarkable record by any standard. As for the final count of her many missions, that proved a mystery for many years. Did Flakbait make 202, 206, or 207 flights? A search of government records maintained by the B-26 Marauder Historical Society proved inconclusive. In fact, those files indicate the plane had actually flown 219 missions, though several flights were never completed because of bad weather or mechanical failures. Joe Romito, a docent and volunteer researcher at the Air and Space Museum, came up with the best number. After reviewing records and checking crew histories, he went directly to the source, Flakbait itself. There, stenciled on the left side of the fuselage, was the answer. Romito commented on his discovery in a 2018 Smithsonian blog post. There are a total of 207 symbols, 200 bombs to represent bombing missions, 199 regular-sized bombs, and a larger one for mission number 200. 6 ducks for decoy missions, and a swastika for the confirmed kill of a German Focke-Wulf FW-190 fighter shot down by Flakbait's engineer gunner, Staff Sergeant Don Tyler, in October 1943. Some sources cite the 207 total as Flakbait's mission count, but the only way to arrive at this number is to include the swastika in the total. This is clearly a mistake, as the swastika represents a successful engagement with a German fighter, not a separate bombing mission. Because of the differences in numbers, some historians doubt that April 17 was the actual 200th mission, though the U.S. Air Force maintains that it is. The aircraft's legacy is inimitable flak bait's survival over the long and bitter air war from 1943 to 1945 symbolizes the patriotism, service and sacrifice of not only the crews they fought in the air, the mechanics that kept it flying, and the people back home that made the bomber, but all Americans that made up the national war effort, Kenny says. David Kindy is a journalist, freelance writer, and book reviewer who lives in Plymouth, Massachusetts. He writes about history, culture, and other topics for Airspace, Military History, World War II, Vietnam History as well. And we've got time for a little bit more. This article is, this map lets you plug in your address to see how it's changed over the past 750 million years. The interactive tool enables users to home in on a specific location and visualize how it has evolved between the cryogenian period and the present. Oh boy. By Mylène Solly of Smithsonian Magazine. Some 240 million years ago, that patch of land that would one day become the National Mall was part of an enormous supercontinent known as Pangaea, encompassing nearly all of Earth's extant land mass. Pangaea bore little resemblance to our contemporary planet. Thanks to a recently released interactive map, however, interested parties can now superimpose the political boundaries of today onto the geographic formation of yesteryear, at least dating back to 750 million years ago. There's something else that can distract me while I'm sitting at the computer. The results are intriguing. During the early Triassic epoch, the National Mall in Washington, D.C., for example, was wedged almost directly adjacent to Mauritania, yet to be separated from the Northwest African country by the vast waters of the Atlantic Ocean. Ancient Earth, the tool behind this millennial spanning visualization, is the brainchild of Ian Webster, curator of the world's largest digital dinosaur database. As Michael Destrees reports for Mother Nature Network, Webster drew on data from the PaleoMap project, spearheaded by paleogeographer Christopher Scotese. The initiative tracks the evolving distribution of land and sea over the past 1,100 million years to build the map. Users can input a specific address or more generalized region, such as a state or country, and then choose a date ranging from 0 to 750 million years ago. Currently, the map offers 26 timeline options, traveling back from the present to the cryogenian period at intervals of 15 to 150 million years. According to Gizmodo's George Dvorsky, ancient Earth included an array of helpful navigational features, including toggle display options related to globe rotation, lighting, and cloud coverage. Brief descriptions of chosen time periods pop up on the bottom left side of the screen, while a drop-down menu at the top right allows users to jump to specific milestones in history, from the arrival of Earth's first multicellular organisms some 600 million years ago to early hominids' relatively belated emergence around 20 million years ago. To switch from one time period to another, you can either manually choose from a drop-down menu or use your keyboard's left and right arrow keys. Start at the very beginning of the map's timeline, Michelle Debsek advises for Mental Floss, and you'll see the planet evolve from unrecognizable blobs of land to the massive supercontinent of Pangaea, and finally, the seven continents we inhabit today. Fast Company's Jesus Diaz outlines several insights revealed by ancient Earth. 750 million years ago, for instance, Midtown Manhattan was situated at the center of a giant icy landmass. As the description on the side of the map explains, glaciers have covered the entire planet during the Cryogenic period, the greatest ice age known on Earth. Flash forward to 500 million years ago, Debsack adds, and New York City pops up as a tiny island in the southern hemisphere. While London, still part of the Pangaea, appears almost directly adjacent to the South Pole. I'm amazed the geologists collected enough data to actually plot my home 750 million years ago, so I thought you all would enjoy it too, Webster writes in a comment on Hacker News. He is quick to point out, however, that the visualization should be considered approximate, despite the fact that the plate tectonic models return precise results. Excuse me. Obviously, we will never be able to prove correctness, Webster concludes. In my tests, I found that model results can vary significantly. I chose this particular model because it is widely cited and covers the greatest length of time. And Malene Solly is a Smithsonian Magazine Assistant Digital Editor for Humanities. And her website, I won't give you that. Here is, in our last minute or two, some comments from readers. And Waterboy 71150 says, click on Interactive Map or Ancient Earth in the article and a new web page will open with a rotating Earth. Enter an address or location in the upper left. Select a time period from the pull-down menu. And Debbie Klein says, I clicked on it and nothing happened. And on Q says, don't seem to work at all for me. And let's see. Todd Chamberlain says, yes, I thought it would morph from one time period to time period. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That wraps up our time for this week's edition of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. It's been my pleasure to read for you.